Welcome back, everyone. Today, I'm actually joined with Adam Miller, who you'd recognize from parts 2, 14, and 17 of Twin Peaks The Return. I'll hand over the mic so he can introduce himself further.
Hi, I'm Adam.
Of course, everyone knows you from the Chromatics performances in The Return, but I figured it's probably good to start off with your early days about like the bands that influence you the most, the people who influence you, friends, family, and everything like that.
Well, that's a good question. I think that, you know, what really influenced me to start the band is that like around the time when the band started, I just felt like there was kind of like this maximalist approach that people, a lot of bands that I saw, a lot of my friends' band, a band that I was in prior to starting Chromatics, it was just like, I don't know, just like a lot of things kind of all going at once. And I was always really drawn to like more kind of just, and that's not a judgment towards those things, because I do like some of that stuff too. But I think at the time, you know, I was like 21, 22. So I was a little, I guess I was just in search. I wanted to create something that felt a little more direct and to me, and something that feels direct is also tends to be very minimal for me, because as musician or artist or whatever, I'm always trying to just strip away what's unnecessary that's sort of clouding things from like the point or like what you're trying to express. So that was kind of an inspiration, that one of the big inspirations for starting the band. And then I feel like that was a vision that the band, you know, continued to adhere to. So that was cool.
And we were talking about before recording that, you and your brother, Nat, obviously that was an overnight thing. Was there an early age of like, did you get him music first? Was it vice versa? Were there any other factors that really just had you both hit the ground running for this to be basically your careers?
I think that both Natty and I growing up, music was always something that was very kind of a big part in our house. Like our parents really loved music. And I would say that our parents were pretty just accepting of lots of, they liked different kinds of music. They didn't have like a crazy record collection. They had what you would like, what a lot of people of their demographic had, but then they also had like, who grew up in the 60s and 70s had like Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young and the Beach Boys. And but then they'd have like Black Sabbath, they had jazz records, they had blues records, they just appreciate, I think my parents really instilled in me like they really appreciated anything that was real. I don't like to say that in a certain way because it sounds judgmental towards other things, but just something that I guess for me, when I'm listening to, I'm still just such a music fan and a music freak, and I'm always hunting for things that sort of feel like the artist is really, there's a lot of pain and joy in the music, and that they kind of had to make the music, otherwise they were gonna, you know, just something really bad was gonna happen to them, or like it had to come out. That's the kind of, those qualities are the qualities that I'm always looking for whenever I listen to other music. So I feel like in a certain way, I've been thinking about this, just like thinking about my parents' records. And I think that a lot of their records express those qualities as well. And so that kind of got passed down upon to me. But that's no judgment towards people who listen to, you know, things that don't, that I would say, you know, doesn't fall under that category. I like plenty of schlocky stuff too, but it's just, that's mostly what I'm, the kind of just direct, the direct feeling like I have to create this or I'm going to die sort of thing. that's what I'm listening for.
And honestly, it seems like your whole family at large really supported you from early on, because I was mentioning is that I heard you on the Sound and Vision podcast, where it seemed like your family, it was when you were in the Softies back in, I believe, high school.
Oh, I was never in the Softies. I was in this band that opened up for the Softies.
Oh, no, but I would say is that I just remember listening is that Jeremiah Green from SAS back later on, Modest Mouse, was like staying in your room. So I'm thinking is that, like, you know, I was, when I was 15, that's the type of thing that my mom would never have like allowed. So It was so it seemed like they were really like allowing you to like really experiment with like the your music and like who you could like play with and a lot of other factors like that.
Yeah, it's pretty weird. I mean, I would say, I think that, they were incredibly supportive in a lot of ways. I think they were also kind of just waiting for this phase to end. Like, so I could like do something more like sort of at least my mother and my and more her and her side of the family till thinking that I would just sort of burn out on this and do something like a little more less I don't know, people look down a lot of times on the artists or whatever sometimes. Maybe not look down upon, but just something more professional or whatever. Something with that's more, I'm not trying to diss my mom or anything. Something that's more dependable, because I would say to anybody who really wants to go into a career in the arts, you have to really, really love every aspect of it, which I do. And if you do, I feel, then there's probably more of a path for you. But if you're doing it because you want to just be famous or something, it's like, get ready to be like really disappointed.
To move on to more of the music scene at large, I know that like the Seattle music scene, especially in the 2000s, where that was like really pushing boundaries, really supportive. Was there anything around this time that was that helped set up like Chromatics, either its early days or what would later become?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of things. That's a really good question because there's so much to deliver for that. So I was raised in Minneapolis, Minnesota, in the city. And Minneapolis is actually, I mean, at the time I was like, I can't wait to get out of here. This sucks, but there's nothing going on here. But there was like a, I mean, Minneapolis is a really awesome city too. So no diss to Minneapolis, but just when you're like 16 and you see a whole another world of possibilities for your life that exists outside, your bedroom in your parents' house in South Minneapolis. That was my attitude. So there was a big underground music scene community in Minneapolis, but a lot of it was for like over 21. So like a lot of bands that I'd want to see would play at bars, so I didn't get to go unless our friends' parents would take us or something, which they did sometimes, which was really cool. But I was probably after Nirvana because, well, Kurt Cobain was just such a gateway, I feel like, for myself and for like a lot of other people too, because Nirvana really championed a lot of other, smaller bands in the underground that they believed in that were a part of the community that they sprung out of, which was in the Pacific Northwest. So because of Nirvana, I got into things like Sonic Youth and Beat Happening and the Breeders, and then kind of into a lot of Pacific Northwest music scene stuff. And what was really cool was that those scenes were like, it was also DIY. And I think this was like the beginning kind of really like the internet. And we had America Online, and I don't even know if I like sent an email to K Records or if I maybe even wrote them a letter, but I was like, hey, if you ever, I saw that the Softies are coming to play in Minneapolis, can I set up the show? And then somehow, like, they just trusted that some 16-year-old kid in Minneapolis would deliver on a show. So I set up this house show at, or I brought the Softies to Minneapolis at this house show that my friend lived at, that I went to a lot of house shows because I hung out with kind of a lot of old people that were older than me. So through that, I kind of became a little bit connected to like the Pacific Northwest music community. And for the next couple of years of high school, I'd bring bands to Minneapolis. And yeah, it's crazy. I mean, it baffles me that my parents let those bands just stay at our house. They would like just let them crash in the basement. And never had any like weird incidents or anything, or like people stealing stuff or wild parties. It was mostly like those bands were just like so happy to not have to sleep on the floor of some like punk house. I mean, they were sleeping on the floor of our basement, but at least like the bathroom was semi-clean and like we had a Nintendo. They were into that. So, I mean, it was cool. So that, yeah, that's how I met Jeremiah. That's how I met James Bertram from Link and Red Stars Theory. He was Jeremiah's friend. I mean, I just met so many people. That's how I met Sam Jain from Link and Love Is Laughter. I did a show for him. Rest in peace, Sam Jain. But yeah, so when I moved to Minneapolis, or so when I moved from Minneapolis to Seattle after high school, I was just like, I wouldn't say I was like fully, I just knew some people there, like from the Pacific Northwest music community already, and a lot of them were like really nice and supportive to me. And I think in the Northwest there was always like a long history of just really cool music, beginning from the 60s on with like the Wailers and like going into grunge and all these things. And Seattle was, it really changed a lot in the 90s before I moved there. But when I moved there in August 1998, the fumes and the tail end of like what had kind of happened in like the explosion of grunge were still there. And it wasn't so corporatized as it is now. I mean, I just feel like now, just the entire world feels really corporatized. I mean, there was still underground stuff going on in Seattle. Like you, it was, now it's like, it's really, really expensive city to live in. But like when I moved there, my bedroom was like $375 a month, which was like still kind of a lot to me. I remember being like, $375, that's gonna fuck that. It's like now, I mean, you couldn't even rent like a pantry for 375 anywhere. So yeah, so or did that answer your question? I was kind of going off on a tangent
No, I think
there.
it did. It's a pretty good segue because the next thing I was going to ask was, with the early days of Chromatics, specifically those first 5 or so years, there was a ton of changes because there's
Yeah.
that raw sound that you had in the early 2000s. And then when we got to the mid 2000s with Night, there was Lena Okazaki, where she was on vocals. And then Ruth actually came in for Night Drive. What was it
Yeah.
like in those 5 years when it was like everything was tentatively forming, you're trying to get your sound and it seemed like everything was kept on changing and building up. What was there anything that you ever felt like it was building up to what you wanted, or was there ever concerns that it was veering off from what you wanted to begin with?
I think it was like a lot of trial and error and like a lot of joys and a lot of frustrations. I think it's really hard to, playing music with anybody is always a very difficult thing, just because you have to really be comfortable being vulnerable with people, and because you're exposing just the part of yourself that you're not necessarily sharing to the to other people in order to create something that hopefully people that you hope speaks to people in some sort of way. So I'd say like after a lot of time has elapsed, I would say like, most of it's like it's all pretty much great memories, and the bad memories are like great memories now. 'Cause like, I mean, I remember one time we were on tour. This was like Plaster Hounds era. It would just come out. I think it was like late 2003 or early 2004. And we were like, played this house party in Cleveland. And it was like one of those shows where it was like six bands or something. And it started so late. And by the time, like, we were like the main band or whatever, the touring band, by the time we went on, it was like 3 or 4 in the morning or something, which was just, annoying, because you're just in this house in the cold of winter in Cleveland. And we stayed there in the roof, and like part of the roof was like just removed, like missing. So we're kind of like just out there in the elements, and there was like a bunch of pigeons living up there. And I was just like in my sleeping bag, just like super shivering. Our friend Ryan, who we brought on tour with us, he was like a total coast to coast radio junkie. Do you remember that? Do you know that show? Like the program, it's on AM radio. It's kind of like conspiracy theories, UFOs. Like we're just like all huddled up there, like listening to coast to coast, like soup, like as the sun's coming up. And like it's like super cold outside, and like there's like a hole in the half exposed roof. I don't know, it's just funny stuff like that. My point being with the story is when I look back on that moment, I'm like, oh, that was awesome, that was really funny. At the time I was like, this sucks, like maybe I should just go sleep in the van, but which I did a lot of times, but I don't know. We were just, it was felt a little dodgy outside. So I was like, maybe it's better off like staying in the house. So, but yeah, to answer your question, it was, you know, I felt like we were, so I always felt like we would make some progress with like where the band would go, and then it would tend to sort of like implode for various reasons. You know, somebody wanted to leave the band because they wanted to finish school, or like people, this person didn't get along with that person, or like this and that. And so it was always really frustrating because you were trying to just get things off the ground. And then once you felt like you had some, once I felt like I had some momentum going, it would sort of cave in again. But, you know, I think that's just the nature of creativity and a lot of times. And when you're that age too, and you just, you can off, you know, you're kind of more immature. You could take things like really personal. Like, I mean, the first like kind of big inner iteration of Chromatics, it was a pretty acrimonious breakup. I mean, the tensions were always really high throughout that era of the band anyway, which can also make a very, can be an interesting dynamic to watch, like from the audience perspective. But we were all like 22, 23. We didn't really know how to communicate with each other. So we just let our grievances kind of simmer towards each other. We're all friends and on good terms now. Like I talk to those guys not like every day. But you know, I saw Michelle about a year ago. She came to my show with War on Drugs in San Diego, and that was really cool. And like I text with Hannah every now and then, and Devin too. Like, you know, it's a really loving interactions, and that's really, that feels good. And all those, you know, they all went on to do like really cool things. Like Hannah went on to be the drummer of the Gossip, who were always a great band, and they took early Chromatics on tour. So it was like, I think everything just sort of worked out the way it was all meant to. So I don't have any regrets. Not that you're asking me if I have any.
So for this first song that I'm going to showcase, Adam Miller plays guitar on When the Storm Comes by Krakow Loves Adana, that also features Ruth Redelay on vocals.
Sitting in the car with the windows down, oh. A heavier depart, so another one. Thank you.
course, those first 5 years were a little rough in terms of everything feeling tentative. But once Ruth Radelet came on for In the City and then subsequently would be on for Night Drive, it felt like things were pretty ironclad for a set time at that point. Did you feel like Night Drive, because I'm thinking of like In the City and then Night Drive, is that I've never heard a sound like that in 2006 or 2007. Was that something that you all felt like that was coming together right? Or were you unsure of how the public would feel? Or were you just happy of making the music that you all loved?
Well, I'm just going to just speaking for myself here. I think I just had this sense that if I like stuck around and like just kept the band going, I had this weird sense that somehow things would pan out, even though I had these moments where, and by pan out, I mean just like creatively gratifying. I had these moments prior to that where I was like, oh, I don't know, you know, maybe this is just never going to click the way that I want it to. Once Ruth joined, it was like, it was weird. I would say that I'm a person that tends to have like a lot of self-doubt and a lot of negative self-talk in my head. I mean, although not so much anymore, but especially when I was younger then, like really, really a lot of insecurities. But I knew that I was just like, wow, this is like really special. I knew it was like really special once Ruth started singing. It felt like everything had kind of landed into place in a way where there was brief moments of it in the past, like flickers and glimmers of it. But now it felt like the music felt really, really good. Felt awesome.
I think that once we got to the early 2010s that, you know, if Night Drive wasn't big before, the fact that Tick of the Clock was prominently featured at the beginning of Drive and yeah. then Kill for Love came out a year later, that must have been like a huge, like one of the best ways to have Kill for Love be out there just with like Drive. Because I remember back in the early 2010s, like that was a movie that people talked about for months, if not years. And now it's like movies don't have that much of a shelf life. But Drive was like a thing that really moved people throughout for years to come when that.
It was. It definitely sometimes stuff just lands in the zeitgeist or whatever and catches on. And it's one thing that I'm missing about the past. Not that I'm getting nostalgic, but I think that it's those sort of things don't happen as much anymore because everything's a little more decentralized, and there's good things about that and there's bad things about that, but things don't seem to like really hit on the level that they used to, like a movie or an album, because it's just, everything's just sort of on this like weird conveyor belt now where it's like, oh, this is out, I'll sample this now for a while until the next thing. And it's like, and I don't say that bitterly. I'm just saying that's just the way it kind of feels more. And I'm sure, you know, maybe that'll change a year. I mean, I feel like things have really changed a lot, even in the past year from when I released Gateway and my new singles this week. It's just like things are changing really fast. So it's very interesting to me. But I also think that with like Drive and Kill for Love, I feel like it really coincided with the rise of Pitchfork. And we got really lucky because they started championing our band from very early on. And then it kind of grew into this thing and that like this really cool site that, you know, the world directed attention towards. But like that sort of grew as our band grew. You know what I mean? Like, and I was thinking back on this, like kind of in the same way in the 60s, like, or late 60s and early 70s, or throughout the 70s, like how Rolling Stone really grew bigger. And then a lot of the bands that they were kind of championing grew. And I feel like our relationship with that and a couple other music media sites, like their growth, that was really, really helpful to our rise in popularity or to our exposure. So I'm really grateful for that.
You know, the early 2010s, you were talking about how things were not as centralized then as they are now. And Pitchfork was like another.
No, I mean, they're decentralized now. Like they were more centralized because like now or back then it would be like Pitchfork would give something like, oh, this got best new music. And so many people would be like checking it out. And like, I don't know. I just don't know what music media is today. You know, I don't know the landscape, but I just know that it, from what I see, that it's very, very different than the way that it was when Chromatics was rising.
It's definitely a different metric now compared to 10 plus years ago, because like 10 years ago, you could say like very easily that Michael Jackson's Thriller was the number one selling album. Then AC/DC's Back in Black. Now it's Spotify and streaming. It's like those things are just a thing of the past now.
Right, right. Yeah, and then it's weird too, because Spotify is like, everybody, a lot of people kind of game their numbers. So people can, everybody tries to make it, make you think that they're like way bigger than they are on those things, because Spotify shows their stats like 2 million monthly listeners or whatever. And that's not to say that, you know, the stuff isn't popular, but it's just interesting. Like that's how I feel like that's how a lot of people are really judging the validity of music today, which is, it's to all our loss in my opinion, but that's the climate feels like, kind of feels like. But then also, it, because it is decentralized, you know, you can share your music a lot more easily than you could like 10 years ago. There's drawbacks to it and there's pluses to it as well. So I'm not like crying about it.
And this is actually shifting gears away from music and more so primarily on David Lynch, but what was your first foray into watching either his filmography or Twin Peaks? Was that something you did in like the 90s, 2000s, or was it even like right before the return?
Well, I remember when Twin Peaks was on television. Was it on? It was on CBS or ABC?
ABC at the time.
Yeah, ABC. Okay. Yeah, ABC. I remember seeing ads for it on TV because my mom and I always used to watch this show, Northern Exposure. Do you remember that show? Every Monday night at 9 p.m. in Minneapolis. It's like our favorite show. And I remember maybe Northern Exposure wasn't on the same network, but you know, you only had a few channels. That's what I mean when I say things were more centralized, because you only had the options to jump through like, you know, five channels or whatever. So I remember seeing the ads for Twin Peaks and while we were watching Northern Exposure. And then I also remember watching a few episodes of Twin Peaks being like, wow, this is weird and cool. But it was like, also one of those things where back when I grew up kids, you know, if you missed a show, you weren't going to see it again. Like, because like unless it hit syndication or something, or maybe they would show a rerun again. So you had to really tune in and like stick with it every week and make sure that you didn't have something else going on. So it was nothing that I fully was able to dive into. And then in the early 2000s, my girlfriend at the time and I, we rented the Twin Peaks, both seasons, DVDs from the 15th Avenue Video in Seattle, in Capitol Hill. And we watched all of them, or maybe most of them. I can't remember. Definitely all of season one. And we were really into it. And, you know, obviously, that's the first season in particular definitely leaves a mark on you after you watch it. But even before then, I remember seeing Mulholland Drive in the theater. I guess that was like 2001. Did it come out?
Oh, yeah, that's okay. Correct.
Yeah, I saw it in the theater with my friend Joseph at the Broadway Market movie theater, which no longer exists in Seattle. Now it's a QFC grocery store. But I remember... Yeah, that was really cool. I haven't seen that movie since, actually. I need to watch it again. And, you know, probably saw Blue Velvet a couple times like prior to that and throughout the, you know, throughout my life.
The next song I'm going to showcase by Adam Miller is Anemone Tattoo by Fawn. And this has Adam Miller on bass.
Now
to move on to the early days, probably the pre-production of The Return. How did you first get in contact with Dave Lynch, Mark Frost, or even casting director Johanna Rae? Because I know that with Lynch, he doesn't traditionally do like regular auditions, but I feel like, you know, when it comes to the musical acts, that there must have been a whole different approach in terms of who they're looking for, how discreet it was, who in the band was picking up on it, was Twin Peaks or otherwise. Was there any particular story on your end?
You know, it's hard because I've been told different things from people who work with us, but from the people who I trust, there's a take on it. I think that Aline, my friend who used to work for our former management, Echo Park Records, she told me that either, and she told me this a little bit ago, so I might not be getting it totally factually right, but I think she maybe had a connection with Dean Hurley, and maybe she submitted our music through Dean, because if I'm not correct, I'm going to guess that Dean was like kind of the main one responsible for all the groups on season 3 of, or on Twin Peaks: The Return. But I'm sure like what Dean would do is what, you know, finds cool stuff and then would present it to David Lynch. And then David Lynch is like, you know, signs off on it. So I think that that's how it happened. Like, I think that that's how that relationship manifested.
Yeah, based on what I heard from Dean Hurley, it seemed like he was the one that would talk to Lynch about like the music that he liked at the time, and just kind of like getting Lynch to be on board for it. But yeah, no, I remember Ruth Radley. She talked about on the podcast, My Favorite Elliott Smith Song, where she had to stay behind, and then she got to meet Lynch like on her own, like shortly after you all met him first. But what was like, you know, finally seeing him in person? Was he like, you know, what you expected to be? Was there anything different from any preconception you had beforehand?
I know this sounds, I try not to go into anything that I do ever with any preconceptions, because I really didn't have any preconceived notion towards him. I just tried to be like, all I wanted to do was do a good job and move it along. So because they seemed really slammed, and film sets in my experience always seem like to be places of like high stress. And it didn't feel high stress on the set, but I mean, I know that they don't have time to sit around and, you know, do a million takes or this or that, because I don't feel like, you know, the light was hitting my pick guard as like how I wanted it to, you know. So I just try to do my best job and be as professional as possible. And David Lynch was very nice and very friendly and gracious. He came up and introduced himself. He's like, "Hi, I'm David," and you know, stuck out his hand, and he's like, you know, going around to the band when it came to me. I'm like, "Oh, Adam." He's like, "Adam, nice to meet you." And then he was like, "Well, are you guys all ready to work?" And I was just like, "Yeah, so let's go." And so we did it. I think we did just one take of Shadow and one take of Saturday. I can't remember. Maybe two takes of Shadow. But I mean, that was, you know, extent of it. I didn't want to be like, too, in those situations. Like, I just didn't want to be like, "So in Blue Velvet, why did you decide to like put the, you know, in the, you know," obviously, you know, you could do that in another context, but like not when there's like a big television production budget behind it and everybody's on the clock.
One question, because we did bring up Shadow for a little bit. The first one I had is that, did Lynch have any particular influence when the song was being written? Because I think of the second verse in particular and how many parts just like hit the marks of parts 17 and 18 so perfectly. I'd find it hard to believe that Lynch would tell the band at large of like what would happen near the end. But I'm thinking of like, you know, when it says like, you know, "We're driving your car, pretend to leave this town, watching all the streetlight fade. Now you're just a stranger's dream. You're nothing like you seem." It feels like it very much parallels Richard and Carrying Part 18. And it's a little bit of a stretch, but I think when when Ruth sings, "I took your picture from the frame," it even kind of at least tangentially makes me think of Sarah when she tries to smash Laura's photo. And I just remember like after it was one of my rewatches, like, I can't believe how much this verse just ties into the ending. Like, it's like no one would have ever predicted this sort of thing. But here it is in this song. It just feels like it's like almost perfectly laid out. So I'm just curious, was that just something that just like retroactively fit in, or was there anything that David Lynch was saying to you or the band both as the song is written?
No, David Lynch never gave us any guidance or anything on that. So, I mean, I would say it's like purely coincidental.
But it's so wild because it just feels like I've thought about this for years, like no, literally years of just like how much it hits those marks. But I guess the other question I do have is that, and I didn't notice this until my last rewatch, but I'm watching part 17 when it goes to Julie Cruise, the Roadhouse. And I notice, of course, Ruth has that very signature hairstyle. And I notice you and Nat, and I was like, oh, wait, that, you know, there's got to be something unique about what Lynch saw in them, you know, for them to start off with Shadow for the first Roadhouse act, and then for you all to be there with Julie Cruise, no less, in the final Roadhouse act. Was that something you felt like was like almost a responsibility to be playing alongside with her, or what was she like, you know, when you got to meet her?
I mean, it was just, I just felt really, really grateful because I knew when we were doing it, like, wow, this is really funkin' special. But yeah, I really don't know why we opened and closed, like why we were part of the opening and part of the closing. But obviously, David Lynch and everybody else who had a say in the narrative of the show wanted it that way. So I'm just thankful to them for that. Julie Cruise was really nice to me. I mean, I spoke to her briefly. Yeah, she was just really lovely. I, you know, it's just another thing too, where I was like, probably just spoke to her for like a minute. So you can't really dig much deeper past below the surface that, you know, in that period of time when you're just working with somebody like on that, in that sort of area.
And I would imagine that these were all filmed around either 2015 or 2016. When this all wrapped up, it would premiere on May 21st of 2017. Was it something that when you filmed, you just kind of like, you know, you left dormant for a bit until the lead up to the premiere? Or was it something you were like actively excited about leading up to that, leading up to its premiere in 2017?
I was really excited about it because I knew that it was going to do some really cool things for us, obviously. So I was excited about it, but it was also one of those things that I kind of pushed in the back of my head too, because there's been other instances where we've done stuff for like Chromatics had done stuff, been filmed for movies, and like, you know, there's a film crew there and stuff, and then it just doesn't make final cut. Like these things just, you never know how something's going to work out. You can deposit the check in your account and then you're never a part of it. So it's always like, you just never really know what's going to happen. It's always, cause it's just dependent on how things are working through the eyes of the people putting together the film, the song, the television series. But I mean, I had a strong feeling that we were probably going to make the cut because it just seemed like things were aligned pretty well, just in terms like the song Shadow seemed to just fit so well. It's kind of like doo-wop-y chord progression, which wasn't intentional to get it into Twin Peaks. It was more, that was because that's what I was really into when I came up with those chords. I was really into stuff like the moon glows and the Orioles, and I still am, but that was a really big influence on me at the time. Cause I think that like the first or earliest version of Shadow that I had was like late 2012 or early 2013, but you know, it changed too, like over the next couple of years. So hence that's why there's a few different versions of it, or multiple versions.
But no, I remember like when that song first came out, it was like the most listened to Chromatics song by far. It just kept on shooting up day after day, week after week. So I mean, that must have been like a huge deal to be at the end of part two, because you know, it's like we close off with Sarah Palmer at her home. We have the introduction of Shelley, or reintroduction rather, of Shelley. James, where we have the iconic James has always been cool. And then there's the now iconic starring Kyle MacLachlan. I forget, were you all at the premiere for Twin Peaks, for when it premiered in theaters?
I guess there was a premiere at the Ace Hotel Theater in downtown LA. And we performed at the party for it afterwards, so I didn't get to attend the and watch it in the theater because we were sound checking, which is fine because you usually don't get to partake in a lot of things like that when you're actually part of the event. So yeah, we were sound checking, and that was at Clifton's cafeteria, like a couple, maybe like three or four blocks down the street in downtown LA, which is kind of like a legendary place, like in LA. There's like a tree in there, like in the middle of it. I think there's taxidermied animals. I don't think I've been there since. I know I went there once accidentally, kind of like late at night in like probably a year afterwards, but I haven't been there since. So I can't remember what it's like on the inside, but it's a cool place. And it was really cool that they had it there.
So the final song I'm going to showcase by Adam Miller is the song Illusion Pool off his brand new EP. Forward a little bit, but you know, in the last couple of years, you know, you've been doing a lot of solo work. Ruth's been doing solo work. Your brother and of course Ida have been doing work with Fawn. I know we were talking a little bit about the changes of the landscape of music and how different it is of like getting your name out there and getting things sold. But what was it like to finally be able to work on your own and do the stuff that's very personal to you with Gateway?
Gateway to me is like a really special record because it was just a lot of stuff that I had been working on during Chromatics and then kind of like during the breakup of Chromatics. It is a very personal record. It's really fun to make music by yourself, but I do prefer to collaborate with people. But at the time it was really nice. It just felt like something that I had to do. So, I mean, I do make a lot of music by myself and I do make a lot of music with collaborators as well. So, and each sort of fulfill different things for me. But yeah, I mean, it felt great. It felt really good to share it. And I really love that record. I heard it like the other week. I was like, damn, I was like, I'm really happy with this. But now lately, I would say that I've been collaborating more, even with like my latest release. I did have, you know, the artist name is Adam Miller, but my friend Mike works on most of the music with me. Our friend Dan, who mixed it, you know, he chimes in with things. I have some stuff I'm working on with my brother and Ruth and other collaborators too. It's just, there's a lot, but so yeah, it's all different. You know, it's, everybody brings a different energy. So I'm really fortunate to just be working with a whole wide swath of people with different energies and different skill sets and all working towards a goal of, you know, just trying to make the coolest thing that we hope that we can make. So that feels really good.
And one thing I did want to say about Gateway is that I was listening, when I listened to your recording with The Lingo, where some of the material was from like the early 2010s even. But the thing is that when I listened to your album, it just, everything just feels so seamless, where I never would have guessed that there was like those years apart, because there's always that, like, in my opinion, it comes off like a bit melancholic, very reflective. There's a lot of like introspection that's going on, and it all just like blends in seamlessly. Was that ever a concern of like how you were sorting the tracks, of like making sure it like felt a certain way, or was there anything that I'd potentially be overlooking?
No. I'm glad you picked up on that. I mean, I was very, very obsessed with the sequencing, because if you remove those songs out of the context of it, a lot of times it doesn't fully make sense, because a lot of them are very short, and I wanted everything to kind of just be like, maybe just like a bit like a dream, or like, you know, nothing. I just didn't want things to overstay their welcome, like just sort of get in there and get out there and then flow into the next thing. So it was very, that's why it feels like really meditative to me. And the reason why it probably feels like kind of introspective is because a lot of the stuff for years, I really need to get back in the habit of doing this too, because I haven't done it for a while. But I mean, I did this for the longest time, where like I would just usually like I'd wake up, and one of the first things I would do in the morning would just play guitar and like record my guitar. I'd play to some rhythm pattern on like a old Korg drum machine or my 808 or my drum tracks, just press a button and then just start playing. And it was just all really visceral. I wouldn't think about what I was doing. I was still waking up. I would just record it and then sort of file it in this library in my iTunes. And I have like thousands of these. And a lot of times what tends to happen is that they just go on forever and overstay their welcome. But in these short little interstices, while they still have the energy before I've like made them hit the wall, like would happen a lot of times, I don't know, they just felt like really great. So it was just a matter of finding the right way to just sort of stitch all those feelings together into one sort of narrative, or just one sort of one entire like whole piece. And I feel like, yeah, I'm really happy with like how that turned out in that regard. Like, I don't know if you, did you ever like Guided by Voices?
Admittedly, I never I was able to give them the chance they deserve. It was always one of those things that I always knew about, but I just never really got sat down to really listen.
Well, I mean, they're a band that's kind of hard to get into in a way too, on an entry level, just because they have so much material, and I only know a small sliver of it. But when, like in the 90s, getting into underground music and stuff. And like that band started, like Guided by Voices probably really had their moment like 93 to 94 into late 90s. But like they really blew up in the underground. And that album's Vampire on Titus, Propeller, and B-1000. Like I love those albums so much. They're such huge influences on me because like, you should check out B-1000 because, or any of those albums, but they'll just be like some weird droney noise that goes for like 15 seconds. And then it immediately cuts to just like some weird chorus thing that goes into a verse. And then that just ends after like a minute and a half and goes into something else. But it's so you're able to follow it. Like it tells a story so well. And I think that was always like a really big influence, or I mean, I'm realizing now that was a big influence on what I wanted to do with Gateway. And same too with like, if you ever listen to like the This Mortal Coil albums, like they kind of do that as well, even though they have more kind of quote traditional songs, but there's all these weird moments where they go into like weird lulls or like they're in this deep meditative moment. And then all of a sudden it just kind of goes into like this kind of harder rock and post-punk thing. And I just always, all that stuff was just always a really big influence on Gateway in particular, but just on how I do music period, especially stuff that I got into in the 90s, like Guided by Voices.
And I know it's I'm going by recent social media posts at the time of this recording, but it seems like your upcoming work when this episode drops in November, that you're kind of changing a little bit. You know, there's a little more vocals for your upcoming work, even vocals that are different from, you know, what you've done in years past. Was there any nervousness of like how it's going to come out when it's released, or is this something you just feel is so ingrained in you that it's like the popularity or the reception is not even a thing that crossed your mind?
Well, you always want people to, you know, you hope that people will check it out and be into it, but ultimately you can't really control that. So if you're going to spend all your time obsessing about trying to control that, you're just going to end up really disappointing yourself. And a lot of the music, I would say probably most of the music that I really love, a lot of people didn't really, you know, it took people a while, or it took its way to find itself it took a while for an audience to find it. So I think that in this landscape too, where it's just kind of like this like playlist streaming landscape too, I don't know. It's just, I think it's harder for people to find things because even for bands that I like a lot, I'm like, oh, they have a new record out. Like it's just hard because there's just so much information out there. So it's hard to remember it. It's hard to, and it's like, it's decentralized as what I was saying earlier. Like, it's not just like from one source or like, or a handful of sources. Now it's just like spread so thin, or it's just spread everywhere. So I really didn't know what to expect, like in regards to, or like how this new stuff would be received, but I liked it. So like, I feel like as long as I'm being honest with myself and honest with the audience, well, because I'm the audience first, and so I try to make something that I would want to listen to. As long as I'm being honest with myself, hopefully other people will, you know, hopefully it will resonate with other people as well. And so far it has on a, like, if it feels really great on a grassroots level. The since the new singles just came out, like the response on a grassroots level has been fantastic, and that's like the best thing. To me, that's the best thing that anybody can ask for, because the grassroots level is like kind of the hardest to get. So that feels really great. But yeah, it still was really scary singing these songs, being like so exposed throughout Chromatics. Like when I would sing those kind of auto-tuney vocoder-esque songs, like I would like sing in this like really high falsetto voice, and then we, you know, it's really, really treated, and I always like that, but like in a certain way it's not my real voice. It's still like a mask, or like a wall So now singing with my quote unquote real voice, there's no, it's just so exposed. And that is pretty scary because you can really deduce a lot, or people, you know, there's, we read in a lot into people's voices and their tone of voice and how they sing and this and that, for better, fair or not. But I was just like, okay, whatever, I'm just going to do it, you know? And at the same time, it also feels really good to be like so exposed and not be hiding behind things. But I still did do some like vocoded process stuff like on this EP, and I will continue to do it, but it, if the song calls for it. But I have a bunch of stuff now where I'm just singing without that, and that feels really good too. So it's just whatever is going to suit the song and feel like the most honest and the most emotional and direct for me as a listener.
Yeah, because at least on my end, and I'm saying this as someone who has yet to listen to it, but you know, I've heard you like throughout the course of decades, where it was always a sound that was like different from what was going on at the time, but people always gravitated to. So I know it's scary to do something different, but I feel like it's worked for you so far. So I imagine come November that, you know, it's going to be something that people will love, because I think that for me, for my the music that I like, it's, you know, it's not what you necessarily want in some cases, but when you don't know that you want it to begin with. And for me, that's what I always loved about Chromatics, and like why I thought, like, you know, it's like for you being there from day one, where you know, you had that certain sound and that sincerity behind your guitar skills. So I think it's going to be great, but yeah, so I just wanted to make sure I put that out there.
Oh, thank you. I hope it doesn't disappoint you, but, but I don't know. I just try to do with whatever is speaking to me at the time. You know, I heard this interview with Robert Smith I was watching, because when I'm chilling out, I like to watch YouTube interviews and performances with artists that I really like. And I've always, you know, I'm a huge Cure fan and always really admired them. And Robert talks about how they just, all their decisions that they made through the band, this was like a early, like a mid 80s interview. He just said, we're like all based upon feeling, like what felt right and what didn't. And I'm sure when you're a band like, you know, The Cure is really massive, but because they're a great band, but also, you know, they made a lot of really good decisions that allowed them to like, you know, stick around and carve a path for them. Like, you don't know the sort of things that The Cure set turned down that maybe had been could have possibly tanked their career, or made their fans lose interest, or this or that. And so I don't know. I always really liked that. I'm kind of paraphrasing what he said, but I always really liked that sentiment. So, cause I feel like that's a good thing to sort of adhere to and just sort of follow. So that's what I try to follow.
And I think people can hear that in your music, because, you know, you were talking about the this sound and the feeling they has. You know, you listen to like Three Imaginary Boys, then Pornography, Head on the Door, Let's Go to Bed, the singles like in the mix there. And he was never someone who wanted to be boxed in with a certain sound, even though it seemed like at least the audiences at the time were kind of doing that. But, yeah, you know, when you look at him throughout the decades, where he was always someone that was always doing something different, and come back to you, where it's like, I think that's what people see in you from, like, you know, with your solo work, and how it's like, it was like, even though a lot of this music was from the early, not a lot, but some of the music was from like 10, 12 years ago, but you can still, there's still something that just like slowly changes over time, and like how you present your music.
Thank you. I really appreciate that you saying that. That's really cool. That's like a really high compliment to me.
But I think we've pretty much caught up to the present. Was there anything you want to plug in terms of, like, you know, the songs that will be out, or performances, or any social media even?
I mean, people can always see what I'm up to on my Instagram. That's the best place to sort of see stuff. I'll announce shows or new music there. I don't really use the other socials as much. It's just, I mean, I feel like you could spend your entire day just like sending out stuff on these things, and it's cool. But Instagram to me at this point is like the most direct, like you're able to reach the people the most who are listening and paying attention to, or want to know what you're doing, even though it feels like they're trying to change that though. Yeah, I mean, I just the Illusion Pool EP is out this November, November 10th. I'm really proud of it. A lot of work. It's a big, I just felt like it was a big like hurdle for me, just just being so exposed like that. That's why the song is called Illusion Pool. It's sort of about the things, the narratives that we construct in our head about that keep us in place, like keep us in our fear. And I think that once you're able to like crash through the surface of that, you find out that it's really not so scary. So that's how really anybody creative is able to sustain themselves, because they are having to I would say that most artists that I know, they have a lot of fear of just being sharing things and being so exposed. And so it's just about breaking free of that. But yeah, and I actually had Lowell Tolhurst, the drummer from The Cure. He plays on two of the songs. Like, we sampled some of his drums on the first song, Illusion Pool, but then he played drums on Everybody's Been Burned, our cover of the Bird song. And that was just, I mean, so cool, because I never would have thought that I would be ever making, music with member of one of my favorite bands ever. And like, Lowell, I mean, his drumming on 17 Seconds, Faith, Pornography, to me, I don't think there's better sounding drums. And I love the way that he plays. There's no flash. I love his rhythms. And he actually, he contributed more than just the drums. He wrote some of those lyrics too. I mean, I haven't really fully interrogated him about it, because I just don't want to be too much of a punisher to him. But he also likes talking about that stuff too, so he doesn't try to hide it. He's a really cool, wise, humble person. So that was just really thrilling, because, if I think when I got into The Cure when I was like 16 or 17, had I ever thought that something like this would have been happening? I mean, you could dream it, but that's it. Once you break through the illusion pool, your dreams can become reality.
But yeah, I think that kind of wraps everything up. I just want to thank you for coming on, because I know that this interview's been like some time in the making, but I think it's very much well worth it.
Cool. Yeah, no, it's been really fun. I think that it's really, I had a really good feeling about you, as I was saying earlier. I really like to do interviews with people who are really into what they're doing, because that, I don't know, if you're not into what you're doing, like, I don't know, it just in this world where everybody's just trying to sell you something, you know what I mean? It's just like, sincerity is like, and authenticity to me is like priceless more than ever. So I just appreciate that you're so hyped on what you're creating, and it's cool. It makes me more hyped on what I'm creating.